If you don't read the newspaper, you're uninformed. If you do read it, you're misinformed. What is the long-term effect of too much information?
Information, information, I just need some information. I've been dying, is it lack of education? I've been reading without any transformation. I'm addicted, is it overstimulation? Hey.
Welcome to the Sixth Sense Report. The Sixth Sense Report.
Hear ye, come one, come all. You are listening to the Sixth Sense Report with Joel Nikoloff and Darnell Samuels.
Yes, it's the two of us back together. It's been a little while, but I'm looking forward to this, man.
I've been missing
my fix.
Pardon?
I've been missing my fix.
Oh, you
know, these conversations are, you know, as much as we enjoy sort of the presenting it, I find it, you know, personally valuable too. Just hashing out these ideas, thinking through things, articulating my thoughts. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I'm addicted to it at the same time, you know?
Yeah, and thinking deeply about some of these issues that we kind of glance over and asking key questions, economic questions, theological questions in our Canadian context. So, I enjoy it, and some of my students enjoy it.
Yeah, especially with the homework assignments. You know, so they don't necessarily have a choice. So it's good to hear that some of them enjoy it.
Yeah. So that's good. That's good. Yeah. So today, what we're looking at, socialism in Canada. Is Canada a socialist country? And we'll be wrestling with the ideas of like defining what it is. Is it good? Is it pros and cons? Looking at the pros, looking at the cons. And end with our usual two cents. So basically where this topic is coming from is as I'm teaching a civics class and wrestling with some of these ideas on, okay, well, a lot of people throw around the term socialism and then they apply it to Canadians and to Canada. And so we're like, well, what is socialism and how does it actually apply? So let's define it. How would you define it, Joel?
I mean, the textbook sort of definition is the government owns the means of production. So in a simple sense, you know, there's a baby food shortage. The government's factory is the one producing the baby food. To resolve that problem is an example of social, a very micro example, but an example of socialism.
Okay, hold on. So government
owning the factory.
Means of production. What is the means of production?
Yeah. So, it's a very broad concept, which is why it's sort of used that way. But really, it's the in the simplest sense, it's the capital assets. But you could also argue it's the contracts to the employees at those places.
Oh, I always thought it was machinery.
Well, it is. But when you look at, let's say the government owns a corporation. That corporation has contracts with its employees. And without the employees, the actual capital assets don't do anything or so they need some level of management. So really what I'm trying, that's why I said contracts, because obviously the corporation doesn't own the people. Hopefully the government doesn't own the citizenry, but let's say the allocation of the employee's time is under the government's direct direction when they own that entity. So if the government's planning the activities of that facility, it's also planning the activities of the employees in the facility.
Okay.
Right? Much like an entrepreneur, right? When an entrepreneur owns the factory and so, you know, they're the one telling the employees what to do. So private ownership of the means of production is primarily, yes, the capital assets. But I'm telling employees by paying them ahead of time for their labor and effort. When I say ahead of time, I mean before the fruits of their labor turn into money in my pocket as an entrepreneur, right? I pay them up front. That product is being built to be sold 6 weeks from now. So I'm paying them up front and I bear the risk, but I get to dictate how they spend their time. And when something goes wrong, I tell them, no, stop what you're doing. Do this instead. right? So private ownership of the means of production is both the capital assets and all of the labor.
Sorry, define capital assets.
What was the word you had originally used? I thought you had said capital, but
no, I just said means of production. So for example, like the machinery that would use. So if you're making t-shirts.
Yeah. So the accountant in me is coming through with the term capital.
T-shirts. What is the means of production?
The capital assets generally would include, you know, the machinery as a good example, but everything that qualifies as something that is long-term of a expense in nature. So when I buy
the business
to run the business, right? So I buy the factory, the t-shirts, the raw material for the t-shirts isn't capital assets, but everything that, you know, essentially goes
to print a t-shirt.
Yeah. Whether that be the building, the front desk receptionist, right? Like all of that.
But hold on. No, wait, hold on. Stop. Slow down. You're going too fast.
Okay.
If I'm an entrepreneur and I want to make t-shirts, right?
Yeah.
The means of production, I could be wrong, but the machine that prints the t-shirts, like I don't own the t-shirts until I purchase the t-shirts. I don't own the building. I'm just using the space.
Okay, but where do you
own?
But
the one thing I do,
you got to think of it this way. Where's the machinery?
No, I own it.
No, but where is it? Is it in your garage?
I guess
in a factory. This is why I said use the word capital asset, because the capital asset encompasses the factory, the machinery, every single piece of, you know, hard asset that is long-term in nature that has to go into a production of a t-shirt. Right now, to your point, you sort of hinted at, well, I rent the space. No, you actually own a liability contract for a year to use that space, right? Mm-hmm. Like, now that's not really a capital asset. I'm renting the capital asset of the building from someone else in that context. But the way government generally works is they own the building and the machinery and they own everything because they just print the money to buy it all. But anyways, that's a sidebar. So when I say capital asset, it's the entirety, because I need a space. I need to own the space to put the machine in. I need a space to store the
inventory. Let's say you're doing the t-shirt in your garage.
Yep.
What is the means of production?
The all of the space, all of the storage for raw materials, everything that from cradle to grave, from the time I buy every raw material to I print the shirt and it goes out my door, mm-hmm. everything that involves producing, storing, is all the generally those are going to be capital assets.
Yeah.
Right, whether that be shelves to organize by size, all of these things are the capital assets of producing something. Mm-hmm. And so the reason I use capital assets, again, is an accountant term. It's sort of the catch-all for land, building, vehicles, right? Like all of our fixed assets is the other term. But again, in the accounting world, the idea is because you capitalize an expense that is long-term in nature, you expense something on your income statement that is short-term in nature. So the raw materials of the t-shirts get expensed when I sell the shirt. But the machinery to make the shirt, I capitalize it and sort of hold it long-term. I don't want to get too much in the accounting because that's a total sidebar and I don't want to bore anyone. But that actual production process is so comprehensive. And this is where socialism and the government owning all of those pieces play a role, right? Like in Canada, if you have the ability to only, for example, sell something through government licensure, right? That's going to affect the market for all of the products that go into selling that thing that you have to be licensed for. So an example I'm sort of thinking of is marijuana, right? Any machinery involved with marijuana is somewhat influenced by how many people can buy it. Well, if the government said only one person can buy it, us, nobody else gets a license to produce marijuana. All of those machineries that arguably have, or buildings or whatever, that are very specialized and can only be used in this industry are going to be influenced by government's decisions. In a manner that when there's a free market, there's competing interests that influence it in a very different manner. And I know it's sort of really down the rabbit hole, but let me give you a good example. If you have a machine that can only be used for let's say, you know, processing marijuana, because I went down that road. If the government is the only producer, you only can sell your product, or make the person who builds that machine can only sell it to one person, the government. And so when I only have one consumer, my ability to innovate the product is dependent upon that consumer. But if I have five customers, those five customers might tailor to different markets slightly, and they might tailor in a different way. And so maybe I do an innovation specific to one customer because of their particular market niche. Well, the government doesn't have market niches. They just own the entire market. And guess what? If you're a niche in a market that's run by the government, you don't even get serviced. Because the government produces en masse, which means I'm going to produce, you know, for 38 million Canadians, maybe let's say half of them consume whatever good we're talking about. Okay, the government's going to produce for the average, because that is how government works. Look at any given government service. They try to do things on scale to tailor to the norm. And public education, prime example.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You essentially have to teach to 30 kids at once. So I have to teach to the norm. The smartest kid in the class is basically bored and distracted because he's finished the assignment in 5 seconds. And the kids that are struggling in the class are struggling because they don't have the ability to get a little bit of time to be brought up to speed to the material that's taught to the average.
Mm-hmm.
So I know I totally went down some really deep rabbit holes, and really some of the examples I've given make more sense under the term central planning. Marijuana in Canada is a good example of that because it's so highly regulated, as opposed to socialism, right? And I, you know, if we use teaching as a really good example, the government doesn't really own the teachers' contracts, but they pay them all. Right? Like there's intermediary bodies in between, right? Like the Toronto District School Board technically has the contract with the union for the teachers, but who's paying the bill? The federal government, or the provincial government through taxation, through federal government arrangements. That's an oversimplification, but to make the point.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right? And so it's central planning is probably a better term. And I mean, I've already sort of started going down the rabbit hole a little bit, but does that, I mean, we can jump into our, you know, some more questions or examples of what is socialism in Canada, but do you think I've sort of answered, you know, what you were trying to get at with what is socialism?
Yeah. Well, and that's why I was asking, just to make sure that, we're clear in case people are wondering, like, what does it mean, for an individual, the private company, to own a means of production versus the government to own it. Now, that definition is traditional, but it doesn't really help us in trying to understand what socialism looks like in our Canadian context.
Well, and I would almost argue it's such an oversimplification that maybe it's really hard unless you're dealing with communism, where communism is almost a totalitarian nature. So, some people will argue and some people will disagree with this, so I don't want to pigeonhole it, but socialism is just the first step before you get to communism. And sort of the reason I mentioned communism is, you know, or even let's say a socialist nation as a whole would mean there is no private property, but we have private property. So when you have a mix of private property and government, let's call it owned property or government owned means of production, it becomes increasingly difficult to sort of draw the lines around what qualifies as socialism. And so I think, you know, just to draw the contrast, what's fascism? Fascism is government control of the privately owned means of production. What's the difference? Largely nothing. They're both central planning. And that's why I sort of was using that term, or making reference to that term a bit, because central planning encompasses fascism. But fascism is what's really hard to perceive if you don't see the underlying relationships. So the perfect example is agriculture in Canada. I don't know if you saw the video. I think it was like a month ago. There was this guy showing a video. He's like, I got to dump out 30,000 liters of milk because the government told me to. Well, what is that? That is called the Agriculture Board or the Dairy Board. And the Dairy Board determines the production volumes of the businesses. This is fascism. The government control of the private ownership of the means of production. So the guy owns his farm. He owns all the cows. He owns everything. But he gets told how much milk he's allowed to produce from his cows.
Okay. Okay. Why though?
So generally speaking, the agricultural board, I would oversimplify maybe, but in generally it comes down to a wartime argument. And that is we need to protect our ability to feed our citizens. So we need to protect farmers. So what the benefit of a dairy board is in the year that there's a shortage, those farmers still get paid. So the dairy board sets prices in a manner to control profitability a little bit, but also to preserve all of the Canadian entrepreneurs. This is also why basically in Canada, it's impossible or next to impossible to have imported dairy. You will find a little bit of imported dairy in terms of cheese. You will find maybe a little bit of dairy from Quebec making its way into Ontario, but very difficult. But largely, it's because it's illegal to bring dairy from another country to Canada. Why? Because we set the price essentially so high that it doesn't even make sense to compete as well. So there's sort of two aspects of that, right? Like the foreigner coming in can't even compete to some extent. But if we had let foreign competition in, the price of dairy for all Canadians would go down. Because we'd be paying the world price of dairy, not the Canadian exasperated. Maybe that's
something. Okay. Okay. Could you footnote that? Just footnote that because we can come back to that point about prices being lower as when we get into.
And I mean, arguably, that's a free trade sort of issue. Right. When we called it not free trade agreement or the free trade agreement in brackets / quotation marks, because free trade agreements are largely regulated. And so that NAFTA agreement is where that kind of stuff sort of gets told. The Americans are like, no, you can't come here. You're not allowed to bring your dairy into Canada. It's going to undermine our dairy industry and we won't be able to protect our dairy industry. So, again, this is more of a fascist position. And this is why I would sort of, you know, point out that when you have a bit of a mixed economy, central planning and identifying central planning is probably a better term to really perceive the consequences of government intervention, which is really what we're talking about when we say socialism, right? The government doing it is what's good about it, what's bad about it. Well, really, what's the difference between central planning? I would argue one might have a worse consequence than the other, depending on the context, but largely they are the same. Right. The dairy example of the guy destroying 30,000 liters of milk that he produced that he just wasn't allowed to sell. What's the difference if the government had produced it and just didn't sell it either because they knew, you know, it didn't make sense or they didn't allocate enough staff to be able to produce the extra. Right. Like, what's the difference? It's still the same quantity, same prices. It's just a different mechanism of the government controlling the actual market.
OK, yeah. So just to make sure that listeners trekking along. So the idea of socialism is government owning the means of production. And then I have a definition here, communism, because sometimes those two definitions can get conflated and can be confusing. And so I have a definition that for communism, that is where the government owns and controls not only the means of production, but also all property. So that there is no private ownership of property, even for homes or apartments, buildings or farms, but all is owned by the government. And so I guess I could be wrong, but the way I look at the two is socialism.
It's focused on gradually. Commerce.
Pardon?
I would say, as an oversimplification, maybe it's focused on commerce. Right? Yeah, all property related to commerce.
Yeah,
including education.
I would say that too. That it has more of a it eventually develops into communism, eventually. But we're not saying that Canada is a communist country. The conversation is socialist, the idea of central planning, that the government is planning out the market, the economy, as opposed to letting the economy evolve on its own, a free market, some may call capitalism. And so just looking at Canada and the way it's structured. But I think this is important to the conversation, that a lot of people have difficulty pinning down socialism and applying it in our context. I spoke to Arnold Kling, the author of Three Political Languages, which is a book we did way back for Type Beast. Three Political Languages.
Oh, okay. No, I was thinking of Coisey's at first.
No. But Arnold Kling. No, Arnold Kling, The Three Political Languages. I was teaching a lesson on three political languages, and I called and I reached out to him. We were speaking, and I said, how come, you know, the idea of socialism, how come in your three political languages, you don't have socialism? He's like, yeah, I do. I have it under, so in his book, the theory is, there's three political languages people communicate by, three tribes, progressivism, conservatism, and libertarianism. And I was like, so based on your political skill, where's socialism? He's like, I didn't use that word. It's progressive. I used the word progressivism, not socialism, because there's a stigma attached to the word socialism, you know. So he just said, okay, you know, just to take out the stigma, he just used the word progressive. And I was like, okay, so we were talking about it in socialism. And he was saying, yeah, like it's hard to pin down the term socialism. That's why I didn't use it. I used the word progressive. And so with that said, the Fraser Institute, they have a definition that is, I think, a bit more accurate of the context where we are today, because the definition of socialism has evolved over time. And so they're saying that this is where we're at right now. So socialism, they say that the meaning of socialism shifted to mean large-scale redistribution. I'll say that again. The meaning of socialism shifted to mean large-scale redistribution. In other words, socialists accepted that firms and industries, firms meaning businesses and industries, should be privately owned, but that the benefits of the markets should be harnessed for collective ends through higher taxes, much higher taxes, to finance higher levels of government spending. So what he's saying is that the way how government has seen things now, they're like, okay, you know what? Yeah, let the entrepreneur own the means of production. That's great.
Partly because when they do it, they suck.
Do your thing, buy black, be independent. Yep. And then when you start making your money, we will tax you. And then when we start taxing you on what you're making, then that taxed money will go towards some kind of community support. And so this is how they're defining socialism today.
Yeah. Now, I think a really easy way to see that, or to see how the shift happened, is that they still view that they have a claim to the means of production, right? The socialist view is now that they have a claim to the means of production, but we realize we're not very good at running the means of production. So we'll let you run it and then take our cut later.
Right.
Because, right. And so because you don't really, you shouldn't own it. It's, you know, the government's property, or the community, the social network, as a poor translation of socialism, but you know, they're the ones with a claim to these assets. And so even though you earned a hefty earning off of them, you need to send it to us so that we can, as you said, have large scale distribution. So, I think it's, you know, that's where I think, you know, the terms socialism is so easily twisted with central planning. Because
I think you're right. I think you're right. That central planning is still a good alternative, better, more accurate term. So then what's your 2 cents on the issue? Do you think Canada is a socialist country?
Oh, I mean, yeah, I definitely do think, you know, we're a highly centrist country is another way of putting it, right? Because we're centrist in that we centralize so many things. And so maybe centrist isn't the right word. Maybe that's sort of people would think of the political.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah. But
you mean centralist?
Yes, not centrist. Yes, centralist. And I always love going back to the quote from an episode we did with Nick Hudson. And he said, it was a quote from him that I repeated back to him to get his 2 cents on it, is centralization removes the means for error correction. And I think, you know, we look at a couple really big industries like healthcare and education, and Canada has so deep the central planning. A very controlled approach, very standardization. As much as it does push down to the provincial level a bit, and some, you know, we already talked about local school boards, the standardization of those things are very common, in such that, you know, especially both of those, to get some means of alternative is either exceptionally expensive or almost you have to go to another country, right? So I'm thinking of healthcare. How many people are become tourist patients? They travel because it's quicker, or they can find the more customed, let's call it, treatment. And a really good example of that, I think, is go look at the types of blood work that you can't get in Canada. There's actually a whole bunch of things that you just can't get. Why? Because the government covers most blood work. And so as an agency that does, you know, testing in Canada, who am I going to tailor to? Basically OHIP and the couple of things that I can get, maybe that are exceptionally common, that people that isn't covered by OHIP. And for our American listeners, OHIP being the, or I guess not, that's the Ontario Health something insurance. I don't know. But anyways, we always refer to OHIP as what covers our expenses with healthcare. And so I know there's certain tests we had to run for my wife that we had to send the you know, blood, let's say, to a lab in the States that would be able to run that test, because in Canada, it just doesn't exist. And so these are the problems with a high level of central planning, is that you remove the opportunity for entrepreneurs to come along and solve problems that the market currently isn't, because you become a high barrier to entry, or there is no ability to enter. And when I say high barrier entry, well, oh, you need to be, you know, a multi-million dollar hospital to do these things. Or in an education wise, you need to have certain certifications, right? How many private schools cost less than $10,000 a year? Not many. Why? Well, I would say there's a bit of a high cost, but it's really just the entire atmosphere of education is under the, let's call it, the paradigm of public schooling. And so even to do schooling outside of that paradigm is very difficult. And I think as technology is coming, I've been saying this for a while, I'm sure I've said it on the podcast, I expect Uberization of education. So Darnell, what about you? I know I went on a bit of rant there. I hope the audience thinks that, or sees that, I think we are a very central planning oriented country. I mean, I think a simple example of that is we largely had the same response to the last 3 years across the country. You know, there was a little bit of tailoring by region, but for the most part, the same response across the country. Whereas America is a great example of a high variability state by state, because they don't have a central plan from the federal level perspective that we do. So I already started to transition to you, but Darnell, what's your 2 cents?
So I watched a video called How Socialist is Canada? And in it, this woman, Jasmine Moulton, she starts talking about how socialist is Canada. And she brought up a point about we'll put the link in the show notes. It was through True North, and she was basically saying that prior to Trudeau coming into office, you know, there was a poll done to see how much involvement the government had in running the economy. And it was before Trudeau, 64% government involvement in running the economy. Now, with that said, there's no such thing as like a pure socialist capitalist economy. Usually it's a mixed, it's a mix of both. But in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, well, if we're starting at everything's 50-50, which one is the economy heavily reliant on? And so 64% before Trudeau comes in. If anybody's been following Trudeau's work, it's probably increased more than that. And so we see that in the increased taxes. So that's one sign. So for example, she used an example that there was a video she shows from Six Buzz. And in the video, it shows, okay, what if you were to make $1 million in Ontario? how much would you take home? And then it showed that the federal at the end of you take out all the taxes, it's about 51% being taken out, and you end up with $489,683, right? So it's basically half of the million that's gone because of our taxes. We also mm-hmm. can see that we are heavily socialized. We have a lot of social programs for our country, which draws a lot of immigrants to our country. So those are reasons why I would say Canada is primarily a socialist country rather than a capitalist country. Although mm-hmm. there is capitalism here as well. So I think one of the key questions is Canada being socialist bad? And I would say it depends. If you are dependent on social programs, it's great. If you're not, it's not great.
Well, and I would, sense. Yeah, and I would say, if I was to caveat your statement, and that, in a moment you are right, but on a long-term horizon, I would say both are worse off, because largely the social programs that we have are not designed inherently to be stopping, right? Like, they're not designed where we transition you back to being off of the program. Again, I'm not talking about the person, you know, just to give a caveat, the people are that need long-term help, right? Like, you know, there's people in society that just can't provide for themselves. Parking those, the idea of these programs coming alongside and helping you get back and integrate back, right? So if you're in public housing, how do we get you out of public housing and onto your, like, supporting yourself, right? The programs themselves aren't inherently designed that way. And so a lot of times, if you've ever heard of something called the welfare cliff, these programs become a burden from actually stepping out, because they sort of force you to stay there. Otherwise you end up in this gap where you end up earning more money, but you actually have less take home because these programs fall off. Right. And that's the concept of the welfare cliff, because, you know, you'll make, oh, if I got a raise of $5,000, oh, I no longer qualify for this, or I no longer qualify for that. And actually it cost me $6,000 to take the $5,000 raise. Right. So I know it's an oversimplification, but I think it's at least, I think, Darnell, you would agree that even though in the moment that you're on the program, it's beneficial, on the long-term horizon, what would your life have been without the social program? You actually probably would have ended up better off in the long run, because you may not have ended up, like, how many people end up on these programs for 30 years? Mm-hmm. I know that's a little bit of a rebuttal maybe to what you were saying, but I think it's such a nuanced point that the programs are helpful in a moment, but that doesn't actually mean they're long-term helpful.
Mm-hmm. Well, let us know what you guys think.
Yeah, give us your two cents. Tell us maybe where you think I'm an idiot and why socialism is so good.
Yeah, you can email us at sixcentsreport@gmail.com. You could follow us on YouTube and Instagram and Twitter under the same handle, Six Sense Report.
And find us me on all the socials, including Instagram again, TJoelN39.
He's back.
I don't know how they gave me they deleted my profile and gave me back my username, which makes no sense to me. Sort of tells me they didn't really delete me for a good reason. At least if I understand correctly, when you get like banned or whatever, kicked off, it's like you're suspended. The fact that I could get my username back just seemed, I don't even know. I just signed up again with the same username.
I think they're just being petty. Stick it to the man.
Yeah. No, exactly. It's that's sort of my thought, is that I wasn't really banned or kicked off. They just were like, well, we're going to nuke your profile. I don't know, man. Anyways.
Yeah. You can find me at Do Good at Darnell on Twitter and Instagram, and Darnell Samuels on Facebook.
But you heard me? Does that make sense?
Madden and Mitchell Media.